I'm Levy Dalton.
And I'm Erin Scala.
And this is I'll Drink to That, a weekly behind-the-scenes look at the wine business.
Are you guys ready to get warmed up? Because I am.
Sometimes listening to a vineyard can tell you more about it than any tech sheet. Here are a few soundscapes from some vineyards I visited recently. You'll hear three different soundscapes, all from central Otago, New Zealand. First up is the Slapjack Vineyard from Terra Sancta. You can hear several birds singing their songs. Now we'll listen to the vineyards at Burn Cottage. Here, you can hear two birds talking to each other. And finally, we'll listen to the vineyards at Pisa Range. I got lucky because normally winds rip through this vineyard. But in this one, you get to hear some, you guessed it, birds. All of this amazing wildlife is one of the reasons why New Zealand has to net their vines as soon as their grapes ripen. All of these hungry birds are waiting to swoop in and eat all the grapes. So next time you're in a vineyard, pause for a moment and just listen. You might learn a lot about where you are just from the sounds.
Hey, it's Linda here from Contra Restaurant, and I just wanted to talk to you about how great 750 is. First of all, there's this great search function. You can either find the supplier of the wine that you love, or you can find the wine that you love and who brings it in. You can also plan your week, your busy week of tastings. They've got a nice listing of all the events that are coming up. And, you know, I wish I had known about this before we opened, but I was a little late to the game. But they've got this great credit app function. So instead of having to fill out a single credit app for every supplier, you can just fill out one, submit it on 750, and you're set for the game.
Raj Parr on the show. Hello, sir. How are you?
Great. You?
Great to have you here.
Oh, it's a pleasure. It's great to be in New York.
So you have many, many accolades and things that you've done, but instead of listing them, I thought maybe we could take it from the beginning. You're born in Calcutta.
Yep.
And your family was somewhat in the restaurant business?
Yeah, my parents were not, but my cousins in New Delhi, they were in restaurants, so I used to go to New Delhi. I lived in Calcutta, my parents, and but twice a year I used to go to New Delhi and hang out with my cousins who had a few restaurants there. And since I was 10, 12 years old, I was always hanging out in the office or following them in the kitchen, or just, it was just something I always wanted to be in. Always wanted to be in the food service business. So, yeah.
And originally you kind of imagined yourself being a cook.
Yeah. My mother tells me that I used to be in the kitchen all the time, and when I was really young. And then I remember making breakfast for my family when I was like 10 years old. So I was always just, I love to cook. And when I went to hotel school in India, because there was no cooking school, so that's how I ended up in the U.S. I came to the CIA up in Hyde Park.
Oh, okay. And they have a wine class there. Did you get to take
that? Yeah. That was a great experience because wine, when I got there, wine just got me fascinated. I'm like, what is this? This is grapes. How can grapes be so compelling and so ethereal? So I started to taste wine. They had like a wine club, and I started there. And then when I was when the wine class came about in I think third semester maybe, I decided to take the morning class and the afternoon class. So just kind of sit in both to kind of grasp as much as I can. And that's how I was totally hooked.
Did you realize kind of right away you had a particularly good palate? Because, I mean, of all the people I've ever met, you have a particularly good palate, I found.
Thank you. No, I didn't. I still don't. I still doubt myself. I still, I ask a lot of questions. That's what my instructor told me. He's like, you ask a lot of questions about flavors. And because, you know, I had no experience in wine. I didn't. The first time I tasted wine, like real wine, was, you know, when I was 20, I was with my uncle in the UK. And so when I came to, in 94, when I came to New York, I had very, very basic knowledge. So it was, I just knew it was white wine and red wine. So,
because there wasn't so much wine in India.
No, there was nothing. When I went to hotel school, I was not very far from a town called Goa. And it was a Portuguese colony, and they made this port wine, but really, like, you know, I haven't had it since, but, you know, I'm sure it was no quality.
Might be curious to go back, you know?
Yeah.
Maybe that's the next venture for Evening Land, you know what I mean?
No.
You never know, you know? Maybe Duncan and, you know, Arnaud Roberts want to go out there.
Make port wine.
You know what I'm saying? Yeah. So you stuck around New York and you interviewed with a couple people. Who'd you talk to?
So the first one I met was when Kevin Zrelli came to do a class, and it was my first time I ever met Kevin Zrelli, and his lecture, which I'm sure many people have heard, it basically hypnotized me and everyone around me. The way he speaks, I think the entire, we had probably 100 plus people there. It was just, you know, just look at him and it's like, wow. So, and I hadn't graduated then. So I was just like, I was 4 months away. So he offered me an interview. So I went to interview with him in Windows of the World. And he's like, I need someone right now. I said, I can't, I have 4 months left. So he says, like, come back after you're done. So he was the first person I interviewed. But by the time I contacted him again, 4 months later, it was too late because he had filled the position. So, and then the other person I went to meet was Daniel Jonas.
Oh, sure.
Because I wanted to be in New York City. And I said, this is the place I want to be. And I went to see Daniel, and he was very nice, interviewed me, asked me, his question was, what are the five first quotes? So I answered it. And then he's like, I'm sorry, but, you know, I already have Tim Kopeck.
Oh, I thought he was going to say, I'm sorry, I actually like Burgundy. You weren't supposed to answer that question correctly.
No, I was surprised he asked me a Bordeaux question. Yeah. But no. So then he, you know, he said, like, you know, it's going to be, you know, we don't have position. We have one person, Tim Kopeck is here. So, and he says, you know, you should maybe consider going to work with Larry Stone.
So he sent you across the country.
Just put the name, because I didn't know Larry, because, you know, I weren't.
That's a long bus ride.
There was a long bus ride, and just around the same time, I was graduating 2 weeks after, and there was a big San Francisco article in the Wine Spectator, and I saw Larry's picture there, and then I sent, my resume, and I got a call for an interview.
Because they both work for Drew.
Work for Drew, yeah, and. So I had no money. So I borrowed some money from a friend of mine in New York. He still lives there. He's my best friend here. So
that was probably a pretty good loan on his part.
It was, yeah. It was, you know, he's like, okay, I said, all I need is enough money for a one-way ticket and something to last me a week in case interview doesn't go the right way. So
what was the vig on that? Do you have to send him a case of Sandy every year? Or?
Oh, yeah, forever. No, it was, he lives now in Long Island, so.
See him now and again?
Oh, yeah, as often as I can. So I went to San Francisco, and a friend of mine picked me up, and he said, you know, I'll take you to the restaurant. I said, okay. So I went to the restaurant for the interview, And the manager who had called me back said, yeah, we'll hire you as a food runner. I'm like, okay, I can't go back because I only have one way ticket and I have enough money for 7 days. And I was like, all right, I'll start with a food runner. And I had a six-month visa, work visa, and after that I was to go back to India. So I started working as a food runner and then became a barback, then a server, then a bartender. And at one point I was working at lunch as a server, dinner as a barback. So, you know, I was doing, you know, a few things. And then how Rubicon operated back then was the wine. There was only Larry's Store and Sommelier, and only the bartenders helped putting the wine away. And
so there weren't like assistant sommeliers.
At the time there was, he had just hired Rebecca Chapa. She was there. But, you know, I think she left like a few months after that. So then slowly I kind of, put in my hours and I was there at the restaurant every single day, all day long.
Because it sounds like if you're pulling doubles, you're probably there a lot.
I was there, yeah. I didn't know anyone in San Francisco. You know, I lived in a tiny little shoebox room.
So it was more fun to be at the restaurant?
Absolutely. I knew nobody. So, you know, my life was a restaurant, and I worked all day long, every day. And on the weekend, on Sunday, I used to rent a car and drive around Napa, Sonoma, taste, and try to see what's happening out there. And this is in 1996. So slowly, Larry, you know, recognized my work ethic and my blind tasting. He used to do a Saturday tasting. That's how I learned how to blind taste. And yeah, so that's how, you know, I started to become Larry's assistant. He, actually what happened was one of the managers put me on the floor when I was a server. And he said, oh, you know, Larry's out of town. Do you have a suit? And I was like, oh, I have like one double-breasted suit. I'm like, I hope it fits me. So I said, sure, I have a suit. I came on and started working the floor and, Larry came back from his trip, and he's like, what are you doing here? And that's when Larry is like, okay, you know, made me his assistant, so he saw me work the floor, so.
Must have been a nice suit.
It's been in India, it was okay.
They have good tailors there.
Yeah, they have good tailors.
What was Larry like at that time?
Yeah, he's very different now than he was then. He was super intense, you know, his service was impeccable. It was the service was, you know, a different level. He was very focused on the guest, and he was very strict.
Is that true? Well, he come for Trotters.
Very, very strict. Like you couldn't touch a bottle. You know, if the bottle standing there or laying down, just don't touch it. You know, he was very, and his training was like very, like just very straight. There was no margin for error. Like he used to come. Sometimes I'm working and I have a station. I'm a server at the time. I'm at the station and he'll bring me like a little, like a drop of wine. I mean, like five drops. Like, and he said, what is this? I'm like, it's like 89 Lynchbosch. No, you're wrong. It's 90. And like never, like, you know, he wasn't like, oh, good job. You're like, you're really kind of like, you know, you're good. No, but like he never said that. You know, it was always like, so, you know, I learned in that old school fashion. I mean, I'll never forget one day, you know, there was a Rumier, first time I met Christophe Rumier, there was Rumier and Matro tasting at Rubicon, and there was some, you know, I went down to the cellar, go to those stairs to bring a case and wine up, and somebody had stacked the case, but there was a few bottles upside down, the current vintage. And I brought him up, and he just lost it that the wine is not standing up, you know, things like that. Like things, you know, just if you don't clean the top of the neck, I mean, just, you know, so like it's that training I got was like, you just do not take it for granted. Everything has to be perfect because the guest is the most important and you have to serve the wine perfect temperature. I mean, this is a guy. So I'll give you an example, like Turley's Infandels, you know, back in the 90s. So they were like, you know, kind of interesting wine. They were like, you know, this is so, and there were so many different vineyards. He used to taste every bottle before serving it and decide if it's going to go in a Burgundy or Bordeaux glass.
Oh, really?
Every, like, you know, because Zinfandel, you could serve in Burgundy or Bordeaux. So he used to taste every vineyard, and decide which glass, and like he like his the way he thinks is like it's so that's the training I had. It was very just hard and straight. There's no like this, there was, you know, it was fun because you learn from him, learn from the best, but it's, you know, it was a very different way of thinking. You could, you know, it's everything was very meticulous.
What was Rubicon like at that time? I mean, who was coming in the door?
Oh, it was amazing. It's, you know, I get goosebumps thinking about those days because it was the different era of the wine boom. There was old school wines because, you know, back then we were tasting, you know, a lot of like Burgundies and Rhones from 78s and 85s because, you know, the cellar was full of them. And California was kind of changing into its new incarnation when, you know, when the 94 vintage was, which was, you know, at that time was like a super juicy vintage, and then 97 came out in like 99. It was still like, so it was a the time, and, you know, the wine scene was it. Every producer from the world came there. It was the epicenter of the wine world on the West Coast. And Larry was regarded as the greatest sommelier, you know, on the West Coast, and was Daniel Jonas on the East Coast. So it was like I met everyone. I met Jeremy for the first time when he came there.
Jeremy Sayce,
yeah.
How old was he then?
Well, I think in the interview he says he came to Rubicon with Diana. I was there. I remember that. And that's
conveniently,
how
he doesn't seem to have mentioned you at that. Oh, that's no, kind of a strange snub.
No, Larry Stone is more important. Right? You know. it was, you know, and I met lots of producers, of course, a lot of Hollywood actors, of course, because Francis Ford Coppola was involved, Robert De Niro and Robin Williams. So they, of course,
as partners in a restaurant.
They were the partners at Rubicon. So, of course, they came in. But, you know, I mean, Francis Ford Coppola always came in. And Robin Williams, you know, he used to come in sometimes and, like, you know, stand in the hostess stand and, like, talk like Mickey Mouse or, like, you know, crack jokes. And it was fun. He was, you know, he was totally. And then many other Hollywood actors, and it was kind of a fun scene of, like, you know, San Francisco locals, wine lovers, this Hollywood actors, and then all bunch of winemakers. Every winemaker from around the world, if they came to San Francisco, that was a spot. And then, of course, not only for dinner or lunch, but also the late night tastings we used to have. We used to have a lot of.
There was a great article one time about the late night tastings.
Yeah, I think it was Kate Crater, maybe.
Food and Wine, I think.
Yeah, so she. It was and that happened regularly, and that went on. That, you know, we did those tastings all the way till I think maybe 2004 or 2005.
So service would end up, and then you guys open up a few.
Yeah, we all got together, and everyone brings a bottle, and there was no theme, you know, just bring a bottle, and then we end up having scrambled eggs at like 3, 4, 5 in the morning.
Which whatever. Is a tradition that seems to have continued now and again.
Yeah.
And stuff, the scrambled
eggs.
Yeah,
yeah. It's you know, it was an amazing time because there was an amazing breed of sommeliers because San Francisco at the time had, like, you know, what's happening in New York now, because there was, you know, at the time there was, you know, William Scherer and Christy Dufault, Alan Murray, Andrew Green, myself, and a few others, you know, Peter Birmingham. And, you know, we had a really good community going on. And at the time, New York was, all the sommeliers were, you know, slightly older, so there wasn't the young generation. And then now you see it's like, this is, New York City is the greatest sommelier community on the planet.
I think it was also more French in New York, too.
There were a lot of French. I mean, all the sommeliers, it was, you know, it was very hard to sometimes communicate because it was like, you know, it's very old school. It was, you know. And now it's quite different. So it's
one of the things that struck me about that generation of San Francisco sommeliers you just mentioned is that they all seem to really like each other.
Oh yeah, we were really good friends. We are still really good friends. We try. We don't do late night tastings anymore. We maybe gonna have dinner together. So that's as far as we get. And no more 5 a.m. Tastings. So
do you feel like Larry and that generation was really kind of your springboard for learning how to taste wine?
Oh yeah, Larry. You know, I owe Larry everything. It's I don't think anything in life as a person, as a sommelier, as a winemaker, Larry is the most important person. He taught me what wine is. He taught me how to taste it, and explained every detail. So even though I don't work for him anymore, haven't for many years, but those 3 years were amazing time to work with Larry, but even after that, he was always there to explain and you know, teach you. And that's what mentors, you know, that's what mentors do. And, you know, I try doing that if someone wants to learn from me. It's important to pass your knowledge because you know, now it's much easier. You have Google. Back then,
do you think that's changed the game a lot?
I think so. It's, you know, you can ask any question on the internet and find the answer. Many times not accurately, because even now, and when you think of like old producers who you've met and spent time with, and they're no longer around, and you think you know them really well because you're on the internet and read an article on them, but it's different. It's, you know, back then we used to go travel all the way to see them, and I mean, when I went to Burgundy. I've been going there since 96. You know, it was, you know, there was not many people there. Daniel Jonas was there. Ned. I saw Ned there, you know.
Ned Benedict,
yeah. And, you know, the few sommeliers from New York were there, but no one from California. There was, you know. So it was a different time. And now, of course, it's like the, you know, I used to go and hang out with, you know, with Christophe Romier and, you know, Dominic Lafon, Jean-Marc Roux, they were all together hanging out, and we should like just, it was very low key. It wasn't like a big deal. It wasn't like, you know, it wasn't as you know, now it's, of course, you know, they were important then, they're important now, but their time is much more precious now because everyone wants to go see them. So it's.
And Larry had his own wine project, which was kind of early for a sommelier having his own wine label.
Yeah, yeah. Larry and Emmanuel Camigi, they were, you know, Larry, of course, even though he loved Pinot Noir, Chardonnay, decided to make a Cabernet Merlot and Cabernet Franc. And yeah, it was definitely ahead of time. His Cerida label. You know, I haven't had them in a couple of years, but they were structured wines.
A lot of grip, I remember, especially Cab Franc.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. And, you know, those wines were like, you know, if you have the wines of Arnold Roberts right now, and they were in the same kind of model, same style. You know, they were not the big, intense, because he made 97, 98, 99, and they were like, you know, pure wines, just really classic varietal and just very, very pure.
So you were tasting with Larry at that time, but you also had the tasting group with Wolf Jaeger around that time. How did you end up meeting Wolf?
Oh, Larry wouldn't like that one, but maybe he's forgotten. It was one day when Wolf came in. Wolf came in a lot to Rubicon, but always Larry took care of him because, you know, all the important guests you have, you know, Larry was the man. So one day Larry was not there, and I happened to be there, and Wolf started talking to me and said, "Do you have anything which is amazing, not on the wine list?" I'm like, "Let me go take a look." So I went to the cellar and looked at the bin sheet, and, you know, it was all manual back then. There wasn't computers, everything. So we went up, and I brought down a bottle of like 95, I think it was like 95 Rumier Musigny. And, you know, the cost on the wine was like $80. So I'm like, "You know, we have two bottles, you know, I'll charge you $200. And Wolf's like, "You know, well, okay.
Let's do that."
So I opened up Word. Wolf loved it. So we started chatting after that. And then, you know, he left. And the next week, Larry came back and he's like, "Where are the two bottles of Rumier Musigny?" I'm like, "Oh, I sold one." Oh, my God. That was it. It was, he didn't speak to me for a couple of days. He's like, "You can't sell the wine. It's not on the wine list." And, you know, I didn't know. He's like, "Now you understand. If wines are not on the wine list, don't sell them." This, you know, but back then I'm like, "It's in the inventory." So I, you know, that's how I became friends. Starting with Wolf, he then started to like come in more often and chat with me and share wines. And he decided to start a wine tasting group called Vintages, and he hand selected a bunch of his friends, a bunch of people who, like his mentor for who is at Stanford, and a few others, and we got together, you know, once or twice a month, and we used to taste one vintage of either Burgundy or Bordeaux or whatever, and just taste all the best ones, because Wolf Seller, you know, it's just, the thing of the Wolf is that he of course loves wine and he collects, but he drinks them. You know, it's like, you know, he would have no problem opening 78 Romani Conti at any time. It will never be like, "Oh yeah, I'm going to open it at a special occasion," or so. at that early age, I kind of like discovered like these are like crazy. These wines are like, you know, amazing. And so that was that. Yeah.
And what was your next job after Rubicon?
So after Rubicon, Larry said you should go and work at Charlie Trotter. I said, sure, that sounds good. So, because I, you know, before I left Rubicon, I spoke to Larry and explained, you know, I've gone as far as I can. You're the wine director. I need my own program. So he said, go to Charlie Trotter. So I went for a stage there. At the same time, I was on the same trip. I was doing a little tasting trip with Josh Jensen from Calera. We were in Birmingham, tasting a bunch of old vintages of Calera next to Burgundy. So when I was, I went to Charlie Trotter for 2 days, did my stage. I got a call at the same time from the Kimpton Group. When I was in Alabama, they said that you should consider, you know, be opening a new restaurant, consider working for at the fifth floor in San Francisco. And I said, okay, that sounds good. So I came back, interviewed with them. They offered me a job right there. And Charlie hadn't offered me a job. And then Charlie called 2 days later and offered me a job. And I was like, Chicago, San Francisco. And I was so attached to Larry, I didn't want to go. I'm like, so I called Charlie and said, I'm sorry, I'm going to stay in San Francisco. And so I started working at the fifth floor. It was a little 65-seat restaurant, which was in a little hotel in downtown, in the shopping district on 4th Street. And it had no sign outside. There was like, the chef was George Marone, who was well-known from his days in Aqua. He was Michael Mina's best friend. So there was like no track record, and Larry's like, I'm not sure it's going to work. I'm like, I'm going to give it a shot. It's, you know.
What made you do that? Because that's not even a neighborhood that people live in.
Yeah.
Nobody really knew George Marone before that time. I mean, in terms of like, you know, restaurant writers and customers, you know. I mean, was it really just you want to stick around with Larry? Or why did you turn down Trotter's, which was one of the most famous sellers in the world at the time?
I thought that if I was going to go to Charlie Trotter's at the time, I'll be following in Spellman and Joe Spellman and Larry. And not that that's a bad thing. I wanted to have my own program. And I don't know why. You know,
you wanted to open a restaurant, put your mark on it.
Yeah. But it wasn't like an ambition. It was more to stay in San Francisco. It was, you know, I've never had like a burning ambition to do anything, which is going to, I just wanted to be in San Francisco. I wanted to be in the wine country and learn more from Larry. And that was the primary reason I stayed. And I said, I'll take a chance. This restaurant could do well. I could, you know, I had no idea about anything with the restaurant. So, and I had never, ever written a wine list. I didn't know how to do inventory. I knew how to count bottles, but, and this was a more corporate structure. So you have to like, you know, wine cost. I had never done a wine cost before. So it was.
And it exploded. I mean, the restaurant was very popular.
Yeah. I think it was the dot-com boom. I think it was the first, like, of that time, a focused Burgundy list, very few New World wines. And there was, you know, it was a quaint restaurant. It was really, really like had all these small rooms, and it was, you know, it just worked. And I just kept building the wine cellar, and people kept coming and buying wine. So it was, it just worked. I don't know how, I don't know why, but it was just all our efforts there, and you know, it was a good 3 years.
Because at that time, I remember looking at wine lists quite often, any kind of style of restaurant that was fine dining, and it would often be deep verticals of Bordeaux and deep verticals of California Cabernet. And I remember looking at the fifth floor list, and it was a deep vertical of Ravenna.
Yeah.
Which wasn't popular at that time. It wasn't a big thing. It wasn't in the cover of the Spectator, Ravenna. You know?
No, it was, I remember that I had a whole vertical of Clos back from 1979, and they all went in the $100 range. There's nothing over 200. So it was, you know, you could find these wines. There was, you know, Burgundy was not discovered like it is now. So it was, I remember pouring 86 Celos by the glass. You know, I mean, no one knew who Celos was. I mean, at least in California, this is in 1999. There wasn't a whole lot of Celos happening. There was Bobby Katcha was importing it back then, but you know, it was like we had all the top wines by the glass, and what I discovered in the restaurant, what I learned was that it's a fine dining restaurant, and people wanted great wine by the glass. It wasn't just like, let's just have like 8 wines inexpensive, or just have some, you know, fancy wines that had names. So I started putting wines by the glass, which were like, you know, were great, but not like, you know, instead of putting Silver Oak by the glass, you know, even back then I had like, you know, Allemand Cornas by the glass, or like maybe a Bordeaux by the glass, not just like names you recognize. So people really kind of were experimental and trying new wines. And, you know, there was the natural wine movement was, you know, wasn't around, but in a way it was, because the people who have made those kinds of wines have always made them. It's a very small way.
So what pushed you towards Burgundy? Because Larry, super smart guy, was known more for California at that time in terms of his relationship to the wine list. What was it, the cooking? Was it a relationship with a different importer? What was it that you said, wow, Burgundy's for me?
So the restaurant was described as modern French. So, and my love for Burgundy started very early on when I was at Rubicon. And of course, the Epiphany glass was 86 Ravenau Clos. And I was working the bar, and Larry gave a blind tasting to Rebecca Chapa, and she left the glass at the bar, and I smelled the wine. I'm like, what is this? So it was like...
Did it still have her lipstick on it?
What's that?
Did it still have lipstick on it?
No, there was no lipstick
on it. Okay, I was just making sure.
Yeah, no lipstick on it.
Because you're like, I've never been able to find that again. You know, Le Clos with red lipstick together.
Yes, together, no. There was no lipstick. Yeah, so you know, so that wine was like, I was like, it's amazing. And then, you know, so most people would probably go into California and then Bordeaux or Burgundy. I went straight to Burgundy. I didn't have the Bordeaux path. So, and then, you know, there were a lot of people like Steve Morey and Fred Dame, and, you know, they always come to the restaurant. You know, my friend David Felstein, who lives in Paris, he used to come to the restaurant, and many friend Wolf. So they all drank Burgundy. So I went straight to Burgundy, and I actually also, before all of this happened, I went to Burgundy by mistake. I took a trip. I was in England in 95, and I had a few days free, so I took a train to Paris and then to Dijon, and not to go to taste wine. I was like, Dijon makes mustard, so check it out, I have a few days. And there was some festival
Dijon
happening.
Dijon makes mustard.
Yeah, I know, it's like, you know.
It's like Grey Poupon. Yeah, really,
you know, but, you know, I was into food still.
They do make,
like,
a lot of mustard.
Yeah, true. Yeah, this is when I was still at the CIA, and I went to Dijon, and there was some big festival there. I couldn't find a hotel room. So someone said, oh yeah, the next town has, you know, find a hotel there. So took a train to the next town, was Bonn, and I took the first hotel right by the station. I had dinner at Cabo des Arches when it was an old. It was now it's much you know it's renovated, but it was old school Cabo des Arches. I had snails for the first time. I had Merceau and Volnay for the first time.
You're in a town with a wine press in the center of the town.
Yes.
Right?
So I'm like, what is this place? So I stayed the next day. I kind of looked around and took the train back and went back. And so that stuck in my head. So then connecting that with when I came to Rubicon with Burgundy. So it just kind of, that's how it started.
And you mentioned Katcha, but it seems like you've always had a long engagement with Kermit Lynch and Rappenhouse from Lynch. How did you first meet?
Oh, Kermit. I love Kermit. You know, it's funny that I've loved his wines for many, many years, but I didn't meet him until 2009.
No way.
Yeah.
Because, you know, he's based in Berkeley.
That's
surprising to me. Yeah.
But I had a very, very deep relationship and a great friendship with Steve Ledbetter, who's one of his top salespeople. And I guess he doesn't do any sales right now, but he's still kind of works with a few restaurants, a few friends he's worked with. But so my connection was with him. So he always should like make me taste all the wines. So I never met Kermit until 2009. But the minute I met him and just became like, we knew that it was the same, We had the same language, the same love for wine, and everything he's done. So it was, and since then I've, you know, spent some time with him. And but it was the wines, I think, that was, I think that's, I think the wines might be more important than the man Kermit Lynch, even though he's the one who brought those wines. Yeah.
So what was it like working with George Marone?
Oh, he was it's crazy. He was so energetic. His idea of cooking food, but he was a showman in the front of the house. He was always in the restaurant, like walking around the restaurant, also sometimes serving food, talking to guests, very charismatic. Yeah, it was really, and he really understood that you know, great food and great wine, they have to go together, because, you know, and he was Michael Mina's best friend. So Michael Mina, that's how I met Michael Mina. He came for dinner, and it was...
And he was working at Aqua at that time.
Yeah, and Michael was, yeah, the chef at Aqua, yeah.
Did you ever work at Aqua? Or?
Yeah, for a few months. When I left the fifth floor in 2002, I was the wine director of the Aqua. They had a bunch of restaurants in California and one in Vegas. So I started there. I worked there for, I think, 3 months, and then Michael left Aqua, and then I left, and we started the Mina Group.
What was the chemistry like with Michael? Huh? Did you guys get along right away, or
right away? Yeah, it was. You know, he's like family. It's for years, people would ask me, "Oh, when are you leaving Michael Mina?" And I'm like, "Never." It's like, you know, it's he never made me ever feel that I'm working for him. You know, even before I became partner, it was always like a true collaboration, and that was like, you know, so. I'm not the best with authority, you know, but he never made me feel that way. So, you know, I like doing things my own way, and yeah.
There are several restaurants in the Mina Group now, but they opened restaurant Michael Mina,
yep,
which was off of Union Square, I believe, originally.
Yeah, at the Westin St. Francis, 2004. Yeah.
What was that like?
It was the hardest opening of my life. I think it. It was such a monumental restaurant for Michael to, you know, open his namesake restaurant right in the Westin St. Francis, the Union Square, the only restaurant really on Union Square, in the old building built in 1904.
That it's was a beautiful building.
It's a great building, and just to have, you know, Michael there all the time, and, you know, you're starting a new company and you're starting your flagship restaurant right there. So it was, I know the, you know, the space was large. It was 90 seats approximately, but it was a large space.
Tall ceilings.
Yeah. And the wine cellar was a 5-minute run. And of course.
Is that on a good day or a bad day, 5 minutes?
Yeah, it was like, you go down the stairs, two flight stairs. Then you run like 100 yards, make a left turn, open one gate, open another door, go in. It was like, you know, we were just soaking wet the whole way through service. And of course, you know, I couldn't take an easy route and just say, oh, let's have a small wine list and, you know, everyone's happy. I said, no, we're going to have the greatest wine
list. We're going to blow it out.
Yeah. So, you know, and that's what happened. So we had one small cellar close to the restaurant. The other one was, so it was a challenge, and yeah, made it work. You know, it was an amazing opening. It was, amazing time to, you know, back in San Francisco after I was in Vegas for 1 year in 2003, and you're back in San Francisco, and the restaurant has had a great buzz, and Michael was doing these crazy trios.
Yeah, he used to do the trio, like he used to do pork three ways.
Everything like three ways, so it was like a nightmare trying to pair wine with that.
Was that difficult? Because everything was a different prep.
Yeah, it was very challenging. You have to just nail it. It was, you know, you didn't have... Yeah, it's like you have one wine and for three components. So most of the times I had one wine. Sometimes I had to pick three wines. So it was, but Michael, that's when we really kind of spent time together. And every dish he made sure that, you know, he would first start with me. And then never just put a dish on the menu and say, oh, we changed the menu. So, and we had to make sure that we had the wine ready for it. And, you know,
so he cared about wine.
Oh, he's the only chef I know I've worked with and who changes the dish with the wine. And he would do that even for, like, you know, if someone's having a special bottle of wine and they ordered a dish, he would change the dish or, you know, add a course to make sure it works, because he understood that food and wine together is more important than them separately.
What would be your strategy? I mean, sometimes you're pairing one wine, sometimes you're pairing three wines with a trio course. Or do you try to aim on the sides, or how did you do it?
There are three components. I would always aim for the center, because first, most people will always start either left to right or right to left, and always the middle component would be this the second bite. And when I was thinking, because I sat down and tried the course with the wines, and I always realized that the wine, the center preparation was always the best, because the second bite was, you know, what people really, like, you know, settled on, and then he finished with the third bite. So,
and they had those, like, special plates that they'd come
with. They were all custom Bernardot. It was over the top.
When did Will start doing consignment with the restaurant?
He never did consignment for Michael Mina, but what he did do is classic Wolf is he did that also the fifth floor. He would just show up with like two cases of wine and say, "Hey, this is for you. Put on the list. It's going to add, you know, it's add to your vertical." And those two cases were like 45 Latour, you know, 28 Lafite, like just like crazy wines, like one bottle, like. And he would just give it to you, like, okay, put it on the list, and, you know, it'll add to your collection. So he is that kind of guy, just the most generous person I know. He never said, "Oh, if you sell it, give me the money back." And, of course, you know, we used to, like, give him whatever we could, but he was just that kind of person. And then in 2009, when we opened RN74, that's when, you know, we started to consign wines from Wealth. Yeah.
And where did the direction come from that? I mean, you wanted to do a Burgundy restaurant, or how did that get going?
I think it was in 2007. I was really, like, at that time we had opened a bunch of restaurants, and I had been with Michael for 4 years, and I was tired of opening restaurants, and I was like, I'm ready to have one restaurant myself. And so I told Wilf, you know, let's open a wine bar together. And he said, "Oh, sure, sounds good." And he didn't tell me, he went and told Michael the next day. So we had a meeting. So Wolf's like, "Let's meet at Michael Mina." So I walked in, and there was Michael sitting there, and Wolf was sitting there. So I'm like, "Oh boy, ambush." So that's when Michael said, "You know, let's just, you know, do two more years of openings, and after that, we'll open our RN74 together, all three of us." So that's how that happened.
And you were in Vegas for a bit.
For a year. Year 2003, yeah, challenging year, 03. Yeah, it was, because when we started Mina Group, the only restaurant we had taken over was called Knob Hill at the time.
That's right, I remember that.
So I was there, and, you know, it was trying to reconstruct the wine list, get ready to open Sea Blue in the same year in 03 in October. So, you know, just wasn't used to living in Vegas. I spent a lot of time living in a hotel. It was tough. And so.
Was it a different market?
Very different, yeah. The way people drink wine, the way people sell wine, it's a very different market. You basically only have like two major distributors. One, basically, Southern Wine & Spirits, and then there's Wirtz Beverage. So two big companies. And you know, I'm used to dealing with like 30 distributors and direct and this and that. So it was like you only had like basically Southern had everything and Wirtz had the rest. There are a few small guys, but you know, not as important as. So it was difficult, you know, and then go through the hotel, union, many layers, can't wind wine directly, a lot of red tape and stuff. It was definitely like not like just pick up the phone and say, "Hey, can I get like, you know, a case of this, a case of this?" It was, you know, it was different.
So do you think that started you on a track of organizational skills? Because now when I look at how many restaurants you've been involved with, covering large programs, doing different projects all around the world, I mean, where did the organizational skill set come from? Did you just hunker down and say, "You know, I got to figure this out"? Or, I mean, what was the genesis?
Yeah, that was definitely, that's when it all happened, when the Mina Group started. Because, I mean, we had one restaurant on the fifth floor, so I could, like, manage it. I was decent with Excel and, you know, pretty well organized there. But when you're starting to plan several restaurants, it gets more complicated. So I had to make my own systems. And yeah, it was, you know, a lot of time on the computer, a lot of time just like making your own, you know, your own system for yourself to operate. Because, you know, if you don't have your own, you know, operating system, it's not going to, you know, things are going to go haywire. So it was definitely a lot of organization needed, something I wasn't used to. So I had to teach myself. And also in the beginning, Mina Group, we only had four. It was Michael Mina, the COO, a CFO, and myself. So it was like a very small company. So we started to, you know, grow up rapidly. And I knew that I had to have all my systems, like, laid out so I can, you know, even today when I do a wine list, I do it in a certain way. And so it's something I taught myself, yeah.
Did Mina himself kind of influence you in that in terms of his ability to run several kitchens? I mean, when I think of expanded groups at a high level, I mean, that's a lot of restaurants that are running at a high level.
Yeah, I mean, Michael doesn't spend much time on the computer, maybe now, but not back then. So he, you know, the inspiration came from his ideas, and, you know, I was inspired by him, you know, his ambition and how he wanted to grow and how systematically everything he went about. But I knew that the beverage program, at the time I was doing all the beverage in the beginning, so I had to really kind of focus and you know, build my own system. So that was...
So RN74 opens up. And what was that like? I mean, one of the things I associate that with is a lot of wines by the glass with the Enomatic system.
So RN74, when we conceived that, you know, the idea was to have a, you know, a casual bistro style restaurant with a kick-ass wine list. And as you know, California is quite a casual place. And at the time, you know, all the great wines of the world are all served in, you know, fine dining restaurants, and everyone's in a suit and a tie and white tablecloth, and everyone's like, and I was like, I want to break the mold and have a restaurant which has no tablecloth, and it's a fun French-inspired bistro with great wine served in jeans or sneakers. That was the whole idea. I just wanted to take away any bit of pretension from wine. And so when, you know, someone comes in and, you know, wants to have a $30 bottle of Beaujolais or a $3,000 bottle of Musigny, they would have the same experience. So until date, RN74 is still designed just like that. We don't try to make it, if any, fancier than it is. It is what it is. Everyone gets the same kind of service. It's friendly. It's, you know, and it's fun. So
because that sort of sounds to me like certain restaurants I've been to in Bone, like Ma Cuisine or something, where it's casual, it's hearty food, but the wine's gonna be, you know.
Exactly. That was exactly what we wanted to do. The wine service we wanted to keep the same as all the restaurants. You know, didn't want to dumb it down or make it, you know, more elaborate. It was that's one thing in all our restaurants. The wine service is the same. You might, of course, one restaurant might have tablecloth, one might not. But you know, all the wines are tasted before they're served. All the wines are stored at cellar temperatures, and it's, you know, so. And the stemware, you know, appropriate stemware in all the restaurants. So that the wine service had to be the same in that restaurant and even in any fine dining restaurant we had. So.
And what was the reception like? I mean, I know it's always been known for great wine. You know, was it more difficult on the food side, or how did things get going?
Well, luckily, our opening chef, you know, Jason Berthold, he also made wine. He made wine with Abe Schoner, actually, and he was a chef, so he understood wine. And that's one of the reasons we had hired him, so he really knows that this restaurant is about a harmony of food and wine. It's not a restaurant which is gonna, you know, focus on the great cuisine. It's gonna focus on great food and wine together. So he understood that. I think people love that. I think people love, like, you know, to have, like, people can come in there and say, I'm drinking this wine, just make me, you know, 2-3 plates or whatever. And people love that, you know. And I think also remember you're opening in April of 2009.
So there had been a little bit of a recession.
It was everything. Our restaurants were dead. It was like, and we were scared. We were like, no one's going to come. It's going to be empty for the first, you know, whatever. And so we were supposed to open at 5 p.m. that day, and there was a line out the door the day we opened. That was April 24, 2009.
But you've seen two recessions because your career path went through 01 too.
Yeah.
So did that change? And then did that inform your decision making when it came to 09?
Yeah, I think so. I think that the one in 01 was a different kind of recession in the restaurant, I think, because in 01, everyone just stopped. Like, they just like, I mean, it wasn't like they wouldn't even go to the restaurant. In 09, we saw at the time the recession was people still going out, but they will just, you know, be a step down. And in many ways, the price point was lower than the normal, but they were drinking more. But in 01, it was just like, there was nothing. It was a different, that was a much deeper, in the restaurant at least. It was, you know, people just stopped going to the restaurants. And 09, you know, and I think that what really happened in 09 was also, luckily in 1974, our clientele was kind of a younger clientele. And it was, you know, because the music was loud and there was like, you know, it was busy. And yeah, the crowd was very different than when 01, just it was, the restaurants had a different crowd, I think.
You've been all around the country and all around the world. How would you sum up the San Francisco clientele for fine dining? What's it driven by, and who dines?
I think that we have some of the most loyal customers. They come back a lot. I think a lot of locals, a lot of people from around the Bay Area. So people living in Palo Alto or in Oakland, Berkeley, and I think there's a very sophisticated clientele. They have a very specific palate. And they like to go, and they know exactly, you know, the style of food they want, and they'll kind of frequent the restaurants, you know, which they like. It's they are maybe less experimental maybe than maybe in New York, but they're very like, you know, they know that, you know, they all grown up in, at least the baby boomers, they all grown up in the Zuni cafes and Chez Panisse kind of, and then now of course there's a whole new breed of restaurants in San Francisco which is totally different than, you know, never imagined. Because there are three distinct layers of restaurants. There's the fine dining restaurants, the Qua and Benum and Reza, Michael Mina, and then there's this like little sliver of just great, interesting restaurants like Bar Tartine, Rich Table, a new Verbena, Nico, all these like, they are like, you know, they add a lot of value in the food. They're a little more casual, but the quality is very high. And then you have the super casual, fun, like, bistros, which are, like, you know, very, very casual. So it's, you know, it wasn't that way before. And before, all the restaurants were either fine dining or there were some casual. So this middle, there aren't so many foots in the middle area, and there's casual restaurants with great food and great wine. It's, you know, it's great.
Even with that vision of saying, hey, we want to do great wine service in a less formal environment, a more casual environment of RN74, did it surprise you how casual fine dining got, like high quality food in a casual environment, how quickly that just exploded?
Totally. I mean, after RN74 opened, they were probably, in the next year, there were 20 plus new openings, and all the restaurants had, you know, tablecloth and fun and casual. Yeah, it really took change really, really fast. And I think, and you know, the same thing has happened in Paris, and to a small extent in New York, it's, you know, it's happening here also. So, you know, they're definitely, I think people want, you know, people want to be in a fun environment. They might not want to be, you know, have long tasting menus. Of course, New York is the only place where, you know, you can still get great fine dining and people want to go out and have the experience. But in San Francisco, it's, you know, people don't want to, you know, most people don't want to necessarily have, you know, long tasting menus and spend 3 to 4 hours in a restaurant. They want to.
I found it's an earlier city. Like, people go to sleep.
Yes, that too. Yeah, people go to sleep much earlier. It's not like New York for sure.
Because, you know, unless it's a really hot spot, like a hip place, like 10 o'clock seems to be kind of the cutoff for fine dining. You know?
Yeah, 9:30. It's, you know, unless on the weekend, but for the most part, it's an early city.
One of the things that's interesting about you is you came up with the generation of sommeliers, and you maintain strong ties with them. I mean, Christy Defoe worked at RN74, for instance. But then you hired a lot of young sommeliers, some of whom have gone on to really amazing things. How did you see the generational changes? Are there a generational change? And what did you look for when you were hiring people in San Francisco?
Yeah, I think the generation changes is, I think, again, it comes back to what I learned from Larry. You know, I wanted to breed or help and breed, you know, young sommeliers because, you know, I was young one day and I was taught by someone. So when I started hiring sommeliers at Michael Mina and then at RN74, I was looking to hire like motivated, passionate, young wine people and like, and hopefully give them all the knowledge they need to go to the next level. And, you know, when I hired Mark Bright at Michael Mina, he was 21, I think. You know, he lived with me and we worked, you know, 80 hours a week for, I don't know, many years just to, you know, and then now he has his own restaurant. He has his, you know, amazing projects he's doing all over the world. So, you know, and that was something I learned because, like, you know, because these young guys teach you something which, you know, which you will lack. I mean, Eric Railsback, when I hired Eric, I literally had to go to L.A. and say, ask him, please come, you know, because I knew he'd be a great, great asset. And he soon became the head sommelier and I learned a lot from him, you know, because, you know, everyone has a different perspective. They have a different style and different palettes. So you can teach them, you know, the basics. But after that, they still have their own motivation. So that was an amazing, amazing hire.
When I think back to some of the people you did hire, like Eric, like Dustin Wilson, it often strikes me how young they were when you hired them, Mark Bright.
Yeah.
You know, in a way that's, at least until fairly recently, different than New York, where they wanted people with a lot of experience. Was that from going on your own story and just saying, hey, I recognize myself in that young man? Or what gave you the confidence to say, hey, a younger guy, I can see this guy's going to work out?
Yeah, it's that, exactly that. It's like, all I need to know is the person has passion, is motivated, and can taste wine. And I can, you know, be confident that I can train someone to get to their highest level. So, you know, I mean, Dustin's a good example. So when I saw Dustin in Aspen, you know, he had passed it advanced and he was in. So, I asked him, I said, you know, you want to come to RN74? You know, give me a year and you'll taste a lot of great wines and hopefully he's going to help you to become the master or become a master only. So he's like, so he took that and he did exactly that. He came there, he worked for a year. We tasted a lot of wines blind and he tasted a lot of great wines and he became a master only and, you know, has a great job. So that was like just knowing that this person is there, you know, and he just needs like one step and then boom, he's you know, in the next level. So,
and one of the things you collaborated on was a book that talked about the sommelier world called Secrets of the Sommelier with Jordan McKay and yourself. And how did that project get started and how did it evolve?
In 2004, a publisher called me and said, you should write a memoir. And I was like, what? That makes no sense. It's like, at the time I was, what, 32. And I said, no, not yet, someday, you know? So the idea stuck in my head. And I spoke to Jordan McKay, who's my very, very dear friend and a like-minded wine taster, drinker with a good sommelier knowledge because his wife, Christy Dufault, is a great, great sommelier and teacher. So I spoke to him and I said, let's, you know, try to, you know, write a book on sommeliers because, you know, someone should have written one by now, and no one did. So we said, let's just, you know, give it a shot. And we started, and we wanted to kind of, you know, first the book have a very kind of concise book and just kind of talk about sommeliers. Then it became bigger. We had got to add food and wine pairing. Oh, yeah, we have to add some regions. Oh, we have to add. So, you know, it became a very personal thing. We traveled around the world. We interviewed, you know, hundreds of sommeliers and, you know, and my fear was that this world of sommeliers is growing too fast, and there's too much emphasis on, you know, buying power and, you know, just being like, and there was a level of humility being lost, and I wanted to kind of write the story of people in the past who never wanted to be sommeliers. They became sommeliers because that's where the life, you know, led them. Richard Betts, Bobby Stuckey, Larry Stone, Fred Dame, you know, Danny Jonas. It's like, so, you know, and I still, my, you know, my goal every single day is to relate the stories, relate the story of all the great sommeliers in the past to the current sommeliers. And because, you know, none of us woke up one day and said, oh, I'll be a sommelier. You know, it just kind of, and now there are a lot of people who just wake up and want to be a sommelier and assume that you go to sommelier school and become a sommelier. But unfortunately, it's not that easy. It is easy, but it's, you know, to be a great sommelier takes years of patience and practice and humility, which I hope that this profession retains.
And have you ever thought about doing a second volume of that book? Is there...
You know, hopefully, you know, one day we'll update it with more stories.
I'm saying I wasn't included, so I'd like to be. No, I'm kidding. No, I'm just, because it seems like a continuing story with the next evolution.
Yeah, you know, it is, and you know, we'll at some point do another version of it. But me and Jordan are working on a different book right now. But you know, everything, our voice is the voice of the sommelier community. You know, that's what's important, because it's not about me or Jordan. It's about collectively as what the whole community does, because it's such a closely knit community. You know, it's important for us to have that voice. So I think the next book is going to be different, but it's going to have the voice of us all together. And I don't know how many more secrets there are, but I think it's all out now.
What does it mean to you to be a good wine taster?
I think that many people taste wine not from the heart, from the head. For me, it's important to taste wine from the heart. That means there's emotion in every wine, and you have to relate with that emotion. Because if you systematically break it down by, you know, color or by aroma or acidity, like, you know, you lose the love for it. Then you start to kind of, you know, because, you know, I've loved wine sometimes, a high VA or has a lot of Brett or, you know, whatever. So, and sometimes when you kind of focus on the negative, it's the same thing in human emotion. If you focus on a negative energy, your all negative energy inside your body is going to become like this big ball of negative energy. If you look at a wine and just identify the one fault it has, you can't enjoy the wine on its own. So a good wine taster has to taste the wine and understand the wine, and hopefully if it's a blind tasting, you know, try to figure out what it is, but also relate emotionally with the wine.
It seems to me, in the way that you've built lists, that you have very strong relationships with certain wines.
Yes.
What are some of those wines, and what have they meant to you?
You know, and that's, it's like a quest, you know, it's like my quest to, you know, find real stories of real people and real wine. You know, it's like the first time I met Jean-Marc Rouleau, you know, and that bond till today is super tight. Dominique Lafon, Christophe Rumier, you know, Aubert de Vilaine, Jean-Louis Chave, all these people. And I went to see them and understand what the philosophy is. And there are many others, Jean-Laurent Vacheron and Jean-Dominique Vacheron, Sancerre, these people. And forever, I will always, you know, chase their wines and love them and put them on wine lists and drink them and recommend them, because they're real stories. And you see the story of the person, you see the personality of the person in the wine. And there are not that many wines in the world you can say that, okay, I see this person, and this person's, how his character is in the wine. You know, it's a kind of a funny comparison, you might relate with this, of Giuseppe Rinaldi. Versus maybe like Domenico Clerico, right? Very, very different people, great, both make two different styles of wine, you know, a different pleasure, you know? And when you go see them and you spend time with them, you get this emotion, and you can tell the story of the wine by tasting the wine, and you can talk about the person while having the wine. So that's been my quest, and it continues. Every day I try to, you know, think about, like, how can you, you know, talk about something, relate with the person who is greater than.
And have you seen that sometimes as a family story? Is there a succession there?
Yeah, succession stories. You know, it's you know, you have to really follow it deep. I mean, of course, succession story, the greatest succession story. I, you know, we was talking earlier about Jeremy Sess and how, you know, I met his father first, and then I met Jeremy after, and I tasted with his father many, many years before I actually tasted with Jeremy the first time. So, not to say that the wine is very different than what his father made, but you know, it's a different person. And making the wine. So of course the wine has, you know, its own attributes and has, you know, has a different kind of focus. So, you know, it's better or worse. People can argue about that all the time, but it's about the person. It's, you know, Jacques is different than Jeremy. You know, they're very similar and very different. So
all the men that you mentioned are men. Is it in a way a male bonding story? I mean,
Yeah, I guess it happened that way. I don't look at it. It's not, you know, I've had great experience with Anne-Claude Lefleuve. That's, you know, met her early on in Burgundy, and you know, it's yeah, it is a somewhat of a male dominant kind of a wine circle, I guess. I mean, there are lots of great female winemakers and men who I haven't met probably, and you know, but yeah, it's definitely male dominant.
Looking at the wine culture in the United States when you first arrived here and started to learn about it and kind of get aware of who was drinking wine till now, what are you happy about? What are you unhappy about in terms of that evolution?
I'm really excited about the younger generation really having an open mind and really, really kind of trying everything and, you know, having an opinion and not necessarily being the label readers, you know, like looking at something. And, you know, I am unhappy about sometimes when there's such a prejudice about California. You know, I think, you know, being, and I'm not saying that I drank California wine, you know, but there is a lot of people who just like don't think California can produce anything compelling, and you know, it's always the old world is always better than California, and there's a good reason for that. I'm not supporting it, but I think people don't give it a chance, and I think with this new generation and you know John Bonnet's book and you know many other stories which people have written and the wines being made, I think that it's sometimes disappointing that people don't give it a chance.
We'll have to have you back to talk more about what you've done to change that in your own life. Raj Bhar, thank you very much for being here today.
Oh, great. Thank you. It's great to be here.
Really enjoyed speaking with you.
It's a pleasure of mine. Thank you.
Raj Bhar, sommelier, author, winemaker, inspiration. Thank you.
Hey, it's Linda here from Contra Restaurant, and I just wanted to talk to you about how great 750 is. First of all, there's this great search function. You can either find the supplier of the wine that you love, or you can find the wine that you love and who brings it in. You can also plan your week, your busy week of tastings. They've got a nice listing of all the events that are coming up. And, you know, I wish I had known about this before we opened, but I was a little late to the game. But they've got this great credit app function. So instead of having to fill out a single credit app for every supplier, you can just fill out one, submit it on 750, and you're set for the game.
And that's our episode of I'll Drink to That. We release a new show each Tuesday and every other Friday. You can find the show on iTunes, Stitcher, or stream it off our own dedicated website, alldrinktothatpod.com, no apostrophe. Thanks for listening, and if you like what you hear, leave us a comment or shoot us a tweet.